everyone. Welcome back to the Wealth Depends podcast. I'm your host, Derek Doyle, and this is Andrew Barron. Today's episode is being recorded on May 28th, 2026.
The information in this episode is current as of the date recorded and is not intended as financial, tax, or legal advice. You should consult your tax, financial, and/or legal advisors before implementing any transactions and/or strategies concerning your finances.
In today's episode, we're going to be talking about making sense of what we would consider a pretty complicated market right now. We're going to be talking about what we think are four of the biggest forces that are currently driving the market and upcoming topics to discuss as we are digesting into what we like to call the summer lows in the stock market. And first, we want to talk about the AI bubble, possibly, and what's certainly been driving most of the returns in the stock market currently. We'll also dig into what we think about some of the current IPOs coming up, SpaceX, possibly Anthropic, OpenAI. There's been a new Fed chair. We'll get into what we think about interest rates and where maybe a cut or hike might go. Also, we'll talk a little bit about the bond market and how that can influence the everyday retail consumer. So let's first dive into what's bringing the markets to all-time highs. The S&P 500 finished last week at an all-time high, and it seemingly wants to continue to go up. A major contributor to that is the semiconductor industry. And what we mean by the semiconductor sector is companies like NVIDIA, TSM, Intel, AMD. All these companies are up in comparatively to the broad index. If we look at memory, you have companies like Micron, SanDisk, Western Digital. We also have the actual infrastructure build out that is linked to the AI trade. Companies like Corning and Vertiv, both respectively up 100% year to date. The question I have for you, Andrew, is there's always a concern when we're dealing with companies that are heavily benefiting from a build-out theme, an infrastructure build-out theme. But eventually, spending is going to have to slow down in terms of to meet the demand. Understanding your time horizon as an advisor is important, but how would you as an investor look to invest currently in a market made up of some of these names?
If you happen to benefit from previously held on to these, and you are up significantly year-to-date, as with any stock, when you bought it, you really should have had sell targets going in, whatever that was. Even if it was pie in the sky, I'm going to double, triple, 10x my money. Whatever your investment thesis is, you should try and stick to that and be disciplined about it. It's easy to get caught up in the narrative. The other word we would use is greed. Just that you get caught up and you see your money going up, up, and when do you sell? And there's a big fear of missing out. But that's why I go back to sell targets. If you were looking to get something and you hit that target, how much higher do you really think it can go? Do you really think it could double again? Maybe. But taking some gains off the table makes sense from a disciplined approach. Because even if you like that stock, you're telling me there's nothing else in the entire market that also interests you that you might want to reposition it to.
Yeah. And this is explicitly important to realize when you're dealing with a lot of the memory names. I read an article yesterday on CNBC that laid out what we're dealing with, some of the growth and how far some of these companies have been extended for the last, call it, 3 months. Micron recently reached a $1 trillion market cap, and it only took 48 days to reach $1 trillion after it was valued at $500 billion. Just for some context, NVIDIA took 500 days to make that same move from $500 billion to $1 trillion. So we're talking about a company that reached $1 trillion exponentially faster than what was previously the benchmark for a very high growth company. And another key point that you want to realize, with especially the memory names like the SanDisk, Western Digital, even Micron, these are very cyclical businesses. So there is a supply and demand imbalance. If supply is here, but the demand for the AI computes here, that's obviously going to draw prices up. And that same article went on to go and say that Micron, a majority of the reason why it blew out earnings during its calls was solely based on price increases. So they're not selling more, they're just selling relatively the same quantity for much more of a higher price tag. So that's just obviously something where, as an investor, you need to be careful about buying into all-time highs when you see charts that just look like this, and realize that it is sometimes a game of hot potato where you don't know when that chart is going to go the opposite direction, especially in cyclical businesses.
To add to that, one of the phrases we hear is how to handle high prices is higher prices. And part of what that means is that high prices and really high margins and high profits will attract other competitors if they see that there's only so many companies participating in that. And I think we're beginning to see that. I think a lot of the big tech players, Meta, Amazon, Apple famously changed over 5-6 years ago to making their own chips. So we're going to see less of the dominant players being able to demand those super premiums when everyone else starts vertically integrating.
Yeah, and it literally takes a quote from Dario, CEO of
Anthropic,
and then Sam Altman, CEO of OpenAI. It literally probably takes a quote from one of them saying, we can do this more efficiently with less memory, and those stocks could tumble 20% if you don't need as much memory, there isn't so much demand to buy those chips, and the prices just go back to meet at equilibrium. So you just have to be careful when you're part of a build out and supply and demand are in balance. It's very quick for those imbalances to come back to normal and then the stock to react accordingly. So that kind of ties into, mention OpenAI, Anthropic. The next kind of topic we want to talk about is some of the new IPOs coming out, possibly this summer and into fall. The most relevant one that's at least been talked about and confirmed to be released is SpaceX. It's set to be the largest IPO ever, with a valuation up to $2 trillion, targeting a $75 billion raise on its initial offering. For some of our audience members who might not be aware of what an IPO is, could you quickly explain to them how these work and why a company might want to go public?
So the simplified version is, during a business cycle, entrepreneurs might need to raise money. And they may start with friends and family and then go into private markets, banks, or other private investors to get to certain milestones. But there often becomes a point where there simply isn't enough money from these markets. You need to tap into public markets, which means your everyday mom and pop, me, everyone's 401k, everyday real investors. And so because there's significantly more people, there's more dollars available. So if you're trying to hit these multi-trillion dollar valuations, you essentially need the deep pockets of the entire populace.
Yeah.
So that's what an IPO is. It stands for initial public offering, and it's the first time the public has the availability to buy into this company.
Yeah, and I think it's also important for retail investors to understand too, is that, like Andrew was saying, these private investors and even these early on employees, they typically have a holdout period where they are locked up for typically 180 days where they can't sell their position in the open market until that lockout period is open. So there really is two kind of critical dates that people or investors should be aware of, is obviously the initial public offering, and also paying attention to when early on investors and employees are then allowed to sell, because it could be a tell for an investor where if someone is dumping an entire position as an early investor or possibly employee, that could signal weakness or strength, depending on how you want to look at it. But it's just a signal to pay attention to, where if are these early investors now entering the exits and trying to get out as quick as possible, that's usually not a great sign.
To add to that, I don't remember what the statistics are, but because of that early investor flight, a lot of IPOs companies 6 months after are trading at lower valuations than day one. It's not true 100%, but it's quite a few if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
So as eager as everyone is to get into the IPO day one, reevaluating it 6 months down the line when we've seen a couple quarters of earnings, et cetera, may actually make a lot more sense and prices go.
Yeah. And I think this IPO cycle is a little bit different than the others because we have three, what we like to call mega cap companies trying to go public. And the reason I bring this up is because typically in a normal IPO, a lot of the major indices don't include them in their broad index. And that includes ETFs, 401ks, buying into mutual funds, yada, yada, yada. SpaceX will be included in the NASDAQ 100, the QQQ, shortly after its IPO. And NASDAQ released a public statement saying, due to their recent updates to the methodology, megacaps now are on a fast track inclusion to be included in the index. So 15 days after IPO, SpaceX will be now included on the index. And that means that anyone who's exposed to this index will have exposure to SpaceX via an ETF vehicle that tracks an index. So that's important also to realize too, where it's like, you don't need to buy direct company stock to get exposure as a retail investor. It is going to be included in the index. This kind of ties into another recent news event that I want to just have a quick discussion with you is on the new Fed chair. Kevin Warsh, who is the new Fed chair, was officially sworn in on May 22nd. And to say the least, he is inheriting a very different economy than maybe he had thought back in his initial hearings in February and March. Mm-hmm. Inflation, the latest CPI print, came in at 3.8%, and that monthly increase was largely driven by energy prices. Mm-hmm. What is one important data point that you'll be specifically watching over the next 60 to 90 days that is a gauge where you think monetary policy or the economy might be heading?
We started the year with a lot of cheap energy, meaning oil mainly, and that has been one of the essential assumptions for the AI build out. So I think 80% of the stock market gains have been due to either the tech companies or the chip companies or anyone that's a part of the construction build out has benefited extremely well. But a lot of that was assuming that oil was going to be $3.50 a gallon. We are 40% up from there. And there's a bizarre unknown if oil will continue to be this price or possibly higher than this. And so for me, July 4th weekend is essentially middle of the summer. And that's when a lot of families are doing a lot of traveling and things like that, where taking advantage of a summer vacation. And if oil prices are systemically higher, that's going to eat into those vacations, which eats into tourism, which a lot of places, their entire economies are based around that. So I see that being a trickle recession indicator where maybe it isn't the final straw to break the camel's back, but we're certainly going to see the beginnings of recession if that is the case.
Yeah. And to put a onus on the rate cuts and where maybe the monetary policy is heading, a lot of the interest rate futures and prediction markets are putting now a 50-50 chance that a hike or a cut might come in December. So it is important to pay attention to these things because as much as the Fed policy wants to try to influence rates, we also have to pay attention to the bond market. And kind of this is our last talking point on today's podcast, but the bond market has been acting up due to some of these higher inflation prints, the Iran war continuing to go on, overall just the economy indicators thinking that our debt levels, specifically our debt deficit, fiscal deficit, is not sustainable. And we've had this conversation multiple times where it kind of ebbs and flows and we go through periods in the bond market where people are more reactive and reacting to this unsustainable deficit. But to help our kind of listeners understand the relationship between long-term treasuries and their everyday lives, what are some things that can have an influence on these long-term debts, like the 10-year and the 30-year and the everyday consumers' lives?
It's really about what investors require to buy the bonds. So a lot of people don't understand how bonds are bought, where they actually go to auction. The country says we're going to raise $50 billion of debt in 1 year, 10 year, and 30 year denomination, or whatever kind of spread they're looking for. And people actually make bids on what they will accept to receive these bonds. And if the country is extremely prosperous, or at least prosperous by comparison, we can have very low interest rates because people, there's such a demand to hold on to these bonds. As people become more and more insecure about the country potentially defaulting because of the extreme debt and deficit, they require higher premium payments to compensate for that. So it really is about where is the country going in terms of growth and prosperity, and what are we looking for as moving forward as a country?
Yeah, and I think it's also important to note that this isn't just a U.S. only related phenomenon. 30-year or long-dated, long-dated debt across the board has seen a dramatic tick up in terms of the yield that investors are wanting to purchase such long-term dated debt. UK's 30-year spiked. Japan was another one on that list. We just happen to be one of the lowest people on that list that is still worthy enough to feel confident about purchasing long-term 30-year outdated debt. But this isn't just a U.S. phenomenon. This is a total global mm-hmm. U.S. countries are taking on a very heavy debt balance across the board. It's not just a U.S. problem. We just want to keep an eye as investors on the U.S. fiscal deficit, because both you and I agree that the bond market is more worried about the deficit increasing rather than the debt number. They don't like to see that the deficit year over year is growing.
The bond market's much more concerned about the trajectory than the total dollar
number. Correct. We do not want to be stuck in a scenario where deficit increase grows and our GDP comes in weaker because we're not now growing as fast as our debts grow year over year. So these are just some things we want to pay attention to. 30-year, 10-year specifically, the housing market has been pretty much frozen for the last 2 to 3 years now with not enough buyers and inflated housing prices.
The real estate market is very localized. I think a lot of places in the West are seeing collapse, major price revisions downward, but the Northeast, Connecticut, Massachusetts, here locally in the Hudson Valley, prices are up and predicted to continue to climb.
Yeah.
So that's not necessarily true across the board.
Yeah, I think it's more frozen for your typical first-time home buyer who needs to take out said mortgage due to mortgage rates being so elevated.
The average age, I think, is in their 40s now.
Yeah. So the housing market has been ice cold frozen for a specific demographic, a demographic that you would want to participate in the housing market, but have been priced out in both areas, not only priced out on a debt specific level, but also priced out in terms of inflated home prices. So interest rates that the Fed can control don't have as much influence. I think people don't understand the correlation that just because the Fed's looking to cut rates, the 10-year moves not in accordance to what Fed policy per se is current,
The federal rate is the overnight rate that banks lend to each other. It has very little impact on the 10-year.
So I think that concludes the four areas that we wanted to talk about. All right. Thank you everyone for listening and watching. I am your host, Derek Doyle.
And I'm Andrew Barron.
And we'll see you next week.
Thanks for watching. If you found this video helpful, give it a thumbs up and hit that subscribe button so you don't miss future updates. Looking for more insights like this? Head over to our website at jgua.com for additional resources. And if you'd like to talk about your personal financial goals, we'd love to help. Just click the Schedule a Meeting button highlighted on your screen to book your complimentary consultation. Thanks again for joining us. We'll see you in the next video.